This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
Let me thank Amri Uriel for this opportunity, but I should start with a couple of apologies with Bob. The first one is that I'm not going to be able to present the paper as you would have done, but more importantly, I'm not going to be able to defend his paper as he would have done. So I hope I'll do a fair job and make sure I'll hook up with a few of the comments that George made so that we can trigger some debate over his paper. So what I'll do, I'll divide up my presentation in two parts. One will be the presentation of Bob's paper, and the other one are my own comments, which basically complement the paper by giving the perspective of a European lawyer who will provide some evidence about a legislation that differs from U.S. legislation and perhaps try to give some interpretation concerning the differences between the two systems. So let's start with Bob's paper, and the paper is a partial defense of strict liability, has two dimensions, a descriptive dimension which is related to the main claim, that is to say, his idea that the core of contract law as it is described in the restatement is organized around the strict liability regime. Now, this idea of core and periphery, it doesn't use the word periphery, but I suppose that's implicit, I think implies something that it'd be nice to discuss, the idea that a good theory of liability regime implies consistency of the regime throughout. And here I think it would be nice to address the question to George, the fact that you could have a regime of liability that is strict for certain dimensions and has fault elements for other dimensions. Nobody, I think, questions this idea in the tort system where strict liability and comparative negligence or foreseeability or other, or the mitigation for that matter, are part of the system. So the question is, why would it be so strange to have a system in contract law that would cut across different regimes by complementing different functions? And I think that's the basic intuition of Bob's, that by talking about the core, recognizes that there are many elements of fault in the restatement itself. So the descriptive dimension, I think, covers two issues. One is the willful breach, and the point is that he describes court's reluctance to use the willful breach doctrine to deter inefficient breach by the promisor. And the other element, which I'll be focusing on in my comments, is the court's reluctance to use the mitigation principle to deter inefficient or reliance by the promisee. On the normative dimension, his comments are related to I think, relatively well-known, even in Europe, and certainly well-known here, positions that is taken over the past 20 years. The first one is that commercially sophisticated parties would prefer rules over standards. And the claim is that they would prefer strict liability over negligence. The second one, which I thought is interesting because implicitly, I believe, in some of the comments that were made, the idea is that strict liability would be incompatible with standards, commercial standards, is the idea that we should look at the liability regime in relation to enforcement in terms of complementarity. That is to say, he suggests that legal enforcement is complemented by non-legal enforcement, and that the choice between strict liability and fault might trigger crowding out of informal enforcement vis-a-vis legal enforcement. Thus, his conclusion is that the strict liability regime might favor the use of non-legal enforcement versus legal enforcement, which is much cheaper and so would generate saving costs. And again, my impression from George Cohen's paper is that standards and market standards in particular would be typical of a negligence regime, but almost incompatible with strict liability regime, which I would question on a general terms, but especially if we take into account the complementarity between legal and non-legal enforcement, it seems to me the strict liability regime can easily be accommodated with the idea of relating to commercial standards. So the conclusion of Scott's paper is that strict liability regime lies at the core of the system, that there are good reasons for sophisticated parties to have as a default the strict liability regime, and but why is it partial? It is partial because Scott claims that his theory works for commercially sophisticated parties, but it might not be as strong in relation to non-sophisticated parties. And so I think the implicit dimension of his paper is that it might very well be the case that we can articulate the system of liability according to the nature of the degree of sophistication of parties and have different regimes according to the level of sophistication. Implicit, I think, although he doesn't go as far as saying what I'm about to say, is the idea that it might very well be the case that non-sophisticated parties might prefer a fault-based regime vis-a-vis a strict liability regime. And I'll go back to this idea of articulating differences, because Bob's paper is articulated around this distinction. Stefan proposed a distinction concerning sale of goods and services. Richard, another distinction. So I think one of the questions is the extent to which we want to think about the liability regime in contract law as a non-unitary one, which might be broken down according to different variables, I'll try to propose my own. All right, so my comments. I'd like to suggest that that there are systems that have chosen in relation to liability regimes a different avenue in relation to contributory or comparative negligence. So that might require an explanation of why we observe in highly advanced system a different choice. But more importantly, I think, what I would like to suggest is that not only national domestic systems have chosen that, but international regimes have chosen that. And so there's something to be said about the idea that perhaps even sophisticated parties might want to choose a fault-based regime. Okay, so let me give you spend just a minute reading the text, because I think, especially for an American audience, it might be nice to look at the way the wording concerning this rule is being articulated. In the Vienna Convention, there are two rules. One is related to comparative negligence and the other one to mitigation. The one related to comparative negligence states, a party may not rely on a failure of the other party to perform to the extent that such a failure was caused by the first party's act or omission. The DCFR, most of you, I'm sure, don't know what it is. It's the proposal of a European civil code. I'm brief on that, but see the principles that was just proposed in on January 2008, but it reflects very much the European principle of contract law. So you'll find a lot of similarities. And here again, we do have two rules. One is the expression of what could be the comparative fault principle. The debtor is not liable for the loss suffered by the creditor to the extent that the creditor contributed to the non-performance or to its effects, and reduction of loss as well. You need to our principal do the same. And then there are national systems in Italy, codification as mentioned by Ariel, of the contributory, comparative negligence existed already in 1865, and then in the 1942, in the German Civil Code, we do not have a specific provision, but the judicial development of the good faith principle brought about that principle as well, and in the French system as well. Now, what do we make out of it? So the world seems to be split, to say the least, in a set of rules that would allow comparative negligence in contractual relationship, both in transactions among commercial parties and in transactions between business and consumer or businesses. How can we explain this distinction? One possible avenue is to think about the different transactions, and it seems to me that complementary distinction might be that of spot versus long-term transactions, the claim being that perhaps strict liability might be a better device for spot transaction, whereas fault-based regime might be a better one for long-term transaction. But I think a functional perspective might be useful to think about a potential explanation for this difference. But let me first state the following. It seems to me that we have to start with the idea that comparative fault is compatible both with the strict liability regime and a fault regime. So the introduction of a comparative fault regime would not be incompatible with the strict liability regime. And here again, I don't find convincing the plea for consistency, because I don't think it's inconsistent the fact that you could have a strict liability regime on the part of the promisor and a comparative fault. And I think many of the arguments that have been made in the past in the realm of tort law might be working for contract law as well. So I think we should start with the premise that we can have both a strict liability plus comparative negligence and a negligence plus comparative negligence regime. So what is, to conclude, the potential, one of the intuition that I will develop in the written paper concerning the different functions. If we think about contractual liability in particular as performing different functions, in particular risk allocation, cooperation, and insurance, as Sol Levmore pointed out, it seems to me that the potential explanation for differences is that European might be focusing more on cooperation, whereas in the discussion that has taken place in these 2 days seems to confirm the idea that risk allocation is at the core, and I think the paper that Judge Posner will present confirms to some extent this idea that risk allocation is at the basis of contract scholarship and contract law in this country. And so it might very well be the case that in a risk allocation setting where that is the main function of contract law, a strict liability regime might perform better, whereas if you want to foster cooperation and sort of using Bob Scott's language, combine front and back end costs, perhaps a fault-based system, unlike what Bob thinks, might be a better one. But I share the view that Levmore pointed out, that is to say, I think one of the key questions is the insurance function. Eric Posner has presented a paper, I think, whose implicit claim, if I understand correctly, was that looking at the insurance function, the fault-based regime might add something to a strict liability regime. And I do think that makes perfect sense, given the asymmetric information concerning likelihood of performances and the level of damages that parties know. So on the one end, the promisor is well aware or better positioned to know the chances of performance, but the promisee knows better the level of damages. And so an insurance function that would allocate the burden on the two parties is supposed to allocate on an either or basis might perform better in terms of insurance, but the need for insurance in contract might differ according to the type of transaction, and so different regimes might be explained by the different insurance function.
It seems like there's a differentiation between sophisticated and non-sophisticated parties, and my concern is, on the sophisticated party side, we're arguing that we need a rule and not a standard, but the idea of a sophisticated or non-sophisticated party is itself a standard, and I was wondering what we use or how we differentiate between the two at the margins.
This is, I think, in terms of what Bob Scott would say, is that it is a matter related to information, contractual power, so I think at the core of this distinction is the level of cognitive competence concerning performances, I don't think is extremely well defined. So, but the functional element, I think, is the idea that sophisticated parties would be able to design the contract, not so much to anticipate contingencies, but to design the contract in a different way from the way unsophisticated parties would. And thus, the combination, the trade-off between incentives and costs would be different according to the degree of sophistication. Stefan?
This is not so much a question, but rather a clarification. Perhaps I didn't make it completely clear yesterday. I do not say that services are all fault-based and goods are all strict liability. I think there is a clear divide within services, and therefore I gave the examples yesterday. My criterion is rather close to what Scott says. I just see the other side, not whether it's the party is sophisticated, but what the other side thinks, because I come from the intention of the parties when they create the contract. And then I say where you say the result somehow is in the hands of the person, then a strict liability a strict liability and a guarantee can be given and can be promised, and that adds to comparability for the other side. Now, I think that sophisticated persons is not a good criterion. Is in principle, yes, but take the doctor. The doctor does not promise the result, and therefore doesn't promise, doesn't give a guarantee. Now, you may say doctors are not sophisticated in legal matters, and being married to a doctor, I would perhaps even accept that to a certain extent, but they are certainly sophisticated persons. So I think it's much more whether a person can promise, well, I can reach that result. That is the core criterion. And again,
just to be fair, I think what Bob means is that both parties would be sophisticated in the medical client relationship. I think there is a symmetric information, so that would not fit with the scheme he's using, because there would be a symmetric position.
Yeah, but then both parties are sophisticated, then they should agree on a strict liability regime.
Right.
Yeah, but in doctor's cases, I would say it's not the case.
That's right.
Typically.
But the client is not sophisticated.
No. They're very sophisticated patients. Contracts between two doctors are exactly the same.
Yeah. Well, it's more the
I think there's evidence for
the substance of what you promise. It's not so much the role of the persons in my view. And long-term contracts or short-term exchange contracts again is problematic, because even a medical treatment of half an hour or so typically doesn't necessarily reach the result. You are right that in long-term contracts very often you cannot say that you can steer the outcome, but for instance a long-term relationship like the distribution distribution agreements, there you can more or less steer the outcome, and therefore I think the criterion is much more whether you can give a guarantee or whether you cannot give it, and that means whether the result is so meaningful that you somehow have it in your hands.
Well, I mean, as far as I am concerned, I would define the doctor-patient relationship as a long-term one, and it's not by chance that I think in most of the legal system that's a fault-based system, and it's not strict liability one. So the long-term element, you generally have a long-term relationship with a doctor, would fit with what I said. Yeah.
But again, I mean, I think that's forcing things into an artificial convention. Medical services are incredibly heterogeneous. You could go to a surgeon for a one-stop life and death surgery, and the typical attitude is he's going to chop you out, and the post-medical care 3 days later goes into the hands of somebody else, and he's off doing the chopping to someone else because he's too good at chopping and there are too many substitutes for the post-op care. And yet you never see contracts for results. And the main reason is because no matter what the medical situation is, the line between the natural event on the one hand, the weak artery and so forth, and the care is sufficiently difficult to do, that the uncertainty is there, that you can't warrant essentially changes of states in nature. And so what you do is you sort of warrant the level of care that you can go in and then try to find ways to design that. If you could contract out in these situations, which you could not do, I think, in effect, the equilibrium position is probably something closer to willful neglect, the conscious disregard. The way in which we get to this in the tort system is that in the stranger cases, this was the point I made yesterday, you see res ipsa loquitur beefing up the negligence standard. Res ipsa loquitur is not applied in medical malpractice cases, except where you leave a syringe inside somebody's body.
Immediately it is.
I'm sure it is in the same cases as it is in America. This is always the problem you get concurrency. The polls start differently by the time you get the exceptions to concurrent. But yes, if somebody decides to lead a forceps inside a body, it's a kind of a res ipsa loquitur presumption. But even in the sponge cases when they're left in, it's at most a very weak res ipsa loquitur, and adverse consequences themselves almost never generated, whereas they certainly will when barrels fall out of warehouse windows. So I think what we're all trying to say about this is that the nature of the underlying obligation, in effect, is such that the pattern is, if you imagine the two most sophisticated people in the world, they're not going to gravitate to a strict liability standard. So when you get less sophisticated people, the strategy is one of imitation of what the more sophisticated people will do.
Well, I find very interesting the argument that you've made, distinguishing between American law and the European law, according to the dimension of the attitude toward the contractual relationship. So you say that risk allocation is more American and the cooperation with respect to contract is more European. Now this seems to me to be a very strong argument, and I have two questions about it. First thing, to establish such an argument, you should show some other appearances that would support it, right? So it's not enough, I guess, even though I think that I would agree with you at the end, but it's not enough, of course, to show that since, we see comparative fault in Europe, and we almost don't see it in the United States, that means that there is such a difference between the two. In order to support such a claim, probably you should show some other appearances in other areas in contracts that would support this argument. In the second, but I think that you may be right at the end, but it's a very strong argument. It actually indicates to a huge difference between the way contract law is understood in America and in Europe. The second point is that shed some doubt with respect to this argument is that if you return to torts, then you would see that actually here again there is this difference with respect to comparative fault between the United States and Europe. Now it's true that today in both United States and Europe you have comparative fault in torts, but we know that it took the United States about 100 years comparing to Europe to import it, right, in the United States until early 70s, there was no, well, some exceptions, but generally there was no comparative fault also in torts. So in the United States, they adopted comparative fault only 40 years ago. While in England, they did it about 60, almost 65 years ago, and in Europe, as you say, more than 100 years ago. So I wonder whether, right, I mean, because in torts, you cannot give this explanation, right? The risk allocation and the cooperation is relevant to contracts, not to torts. So what I'm saying is that one way is to give the explanation that you give. If you focus only on contracts, you could say here it's risk allocation and there it's cooperation. But if you look also to torts, you ask yourself, well, there is some consistency in the Americans' unwillingness to accept, you know, a midway solutions. They prefer either X or either yes or no. That was their inclination with respect to torts and probably also with respect to contracts for maybe some reason that we don't know.
Okay, as to the first question, of course, I can provide at least two more examples. And again, most of them will be grounded not only on European system, but also on UNIDROIT principles, on the Vienna Convention principles, the renegotiation. So the different role the renegotiation has in European legal systems and international regimes and in the US seems to me, again, the proof that the level of renegotiation that is fostered by legal rules in Europe is different from the one that is fostered in this country. And the role of general clauses in really good faith, again, I think it's an element that shows that the use of good faith, both by parties and by judges in Europe, shows clearly that there's an element concerning cooperation that is relatively foreign to the American system. And I think there are many other examples that would go in this direction. Of course, whenever we do comparative law, the idea is not to identify which system is better, but try to give rational explanation which generalize across the line. So I'm not saying that there's no risk allocation consideration in Europe, and I'm not saying that you wouldn't find any cooperation based in this country, but I don't think that purely historical explanation and path dependency explain why we observe comparative negligence in most of those countries and we do not observe here. As to the tort, I think you have to divide the explanation concerning the risk allocation and the cooperation. It seems to me that the risk allocation might be a good explanation both for contract and for torts. Now, at first sight, cooperation itself would not work in tort. However, if you look at inter-victim interaction as a cooperative venture to minimize the level of loss, despite the fact that parties do not communicate with each other, then it seems to me that there's some ground to look at this element as an element that would be cooperation without communication. Cooperation doesn't necessarily need communication to operate, and I think the explanation that we could give for comparative negligence in Europe is the idea that can be framed in economic terms, but also being framed in social terms, solidarity, the idea of cooperation. There's one, you know, might disagree from one economics perspective, but there's 150 years of scholarship and judicial intervention that bases comparative negligence on the idea of solidarity and cooperation in tort law.
Okay.
Very good.
Yeah. I wondered about, it seems to me that from the point of view of the promisee, a comparative fault regime would make contracts less secure to be upheld. From his point of view, he's at greater risk that he won't get the full bargain. And it seems to me that because of that, promisees would systematically rely less on contracts than they do in the U.S. because the contracts are more likely to be overturned in Europe. So do, is that what in fact happens? Do they systematically underrely? Because if that's true, then they would they wouldn't invest as much, count as much on contracts as they would in the U.S. So it seems like there could be a deadweight loss there.
Well, why the definition of a standard concerning reliance that would be incorporated as the case that Ariel mentioned yesterday would make the contract more insecure? It's unclear to me. The question today, even in this country, I suppose that the reliance is an issue. It is not controlled by comparative negligence. It's controlled, as we were told, by other doctrines, foreseeability or others. But it's not that it's foreign to this system. So the issue is there any comparative advantage of controlling reliance by the definition of a standard that would be administered through a comparative fault rule vis-a-vis other doctrine? My understanding of European legal systems is that is not the case. That is to say, the promisee would know the level of reliance, but also the level of cooperation exempted, as much as you would with the doctrine of foreseeability, with the doctrine of reliance. Those are, it doesn't really make, there isn't a difference between the two. Those are both standards. To my knowledge, the reliance in this country is not controlled by a rule. Am I correct, Professor Craswell?
I'm not sure which rule.
It is not.
Yeah,
I'm saying it's a standard. It's not a rule. The level of reliance of the promisee in this country is controlled by a rule or by a standard?
But no,
because you can find examples of each.
Yeah, I mean, if you mean reliance, pre-breach reliance, there is no rule and no standard, right? You can over-rely and get compensation for that, right?
Although even then,
as long as it's before breach,
over-relied and that leads you to suffer damages that are so high that they might be deemed reasonably unforeseeable under Hadley versus Baxter.
But that would
just apply
that way, but it can be used occasionally.
So that would be a standard.
Yeah, it's certainly on a bright line rule.
Yeah, so the idea is basically that the two systems use standards with different doctrines, but still based on standards. So the comparability would be between two different standards and the way they perform as a way to control the level of reliance of the promisee, which needs a lot of empirical work to see cases and see how they come out.
But you would expect that they would be identical in terms of comparative fault having the exact same effects on reliance as this combination of foreseeability and...
No, I would expect they would do better because it seems to me that the comparative fault is a relational criteria. I mean, the foreseeability as well, but the comparative fault is a relational criteria that will trigger much more interaction between the two parties than the foreseeability itself, although I acknowledge the fact that the foreseeability has been interpreted as a relational criterion, and thus the two are relatively converging. But it seems to me that the structure of comparative negligence being intrinsically relational would perform better over time than the foreseeability, to the extent that they're overlapping, because as a matter of doctrine, as Ariel correctly said, they're not entirely overlapping.
What you're doing there is having a split kind of regime, but the way in which you could plead it out in traditional style is you've got a defendant, a plaintiff says the defendant is in breach of this particular obligation, and what the defendant comes back and says, but there was a condition which made it impossible for me to perform. And then the reply to that is, but the reason you got yourself into that pickle was some prior neglect on your part. This is very similar to this sort of antecedent negligence doctrine that sometimes gets brought into play in the tort law. It does require some degree of cooperation between the parties. It says that the defense of the condition is going to be good only to the extent that you can show that there wasn't this undermining effect, which means that you're going to get partial allocation. That is, when the plaintiff reinstates the case by saying, the reason that this block took place was there was some wrong on the part of the defendant antecedently, that doesn't get him full recovery, so you get yourself bound to a part recovery. So the question is if you can, in effect, sort of think of the law as a series of alternating claims, very much in the Roman style, which is prima facie case, defense, replication, and so forth. Every time you go back and forth, the plaintiff who comes back with a replication is never put in the same place he would have been if there weren't a defense or a prima facie case. doesn't that actually get you into some kind of a comparative fault regime with actually a little bit more precision, because you then don't have to worry about the question of, well, here's two things, how do we want to allocate these two costs? Is it a 60-40 case or 70-30 case or a 30-70 case? So I don't see that there's a real categorical difference, and I think that the other approach, pleaded correctly, actually allows you to introduce all the mitigating and aggravating circumstances.
My general comment is that certainly the fact that in many systems there is comparative negligence and in your system there isn't, it doesn't mean that the issue has not been addressed. So I would agree with you that research needs to be made not so much about why it's missing, but where is it?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that a lot of the cases that we solve through comparative negligence will be solved through other doctrine. Now, having said that, but for the foreseeability time, it seems to me that you work much more in the mitigation, which we share, you work much more on the binary system, an either or, which might not end up being an allocation.
Well, no, this is not binary. Binary would be it's a prima facie case 100, defense 0, replication 100. But the argument is prima facie case 100, the defense knocks it down to, say, 40, and then the replication raises it up to 70. So that what you're doing in all these cases is every time you plead something in, you're changing the payoff function at the back end. Just for example, to take the tort analogy, you have an intentional tort, somebody pleads self-defense, somebody else comes back and says there was excessive force, he reinstates the cause of action, but the measure of damage is now different. It's equal to the amount of the excess over the amount of permissible force. So you always get these allocations through the classic pleading system, but I think you actually have a much clearer direction, since you have a stronger substantive theory, as to why the reduction should be taking place, which in turn means that the factual inquiries are going to be done with greater precision.
I would agree with you only to some extent. That is to say, it does. I don't think, but again, this is just a hypothesis, I don't think that the set of hypotheses we're talking about totally overlap. I think there's still a relatively wide range of hypotheses where you still work on a binary and we work on an allocation. Your normative point, one works better than the other. It's unclear to me why foreseeability would work better than comparative.
I regard that as basically a dumping word. Whenever you don't know what you want to say, you use the word foreseeability as an excuse for an answer.
But using foreseeability so well.
But you're saying that it works better than comparative fault.
This is a different notion. If you go back to the law of conditions and the restatements, instead of comparative fault, we talk about excuses for non-performance, right? So they're conditions and they're excuses for not meeting the conditions and so forth. That's the tradition I'm in, rather than the foreseeability tradition. I did not mention that word. In this thing, because
but wouldn't the excuse would generate partial?
Yeah,
that's pretty rare.
I don't think it's so rare in some of these cases. You get some of these delay cases, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm late, and I say, well, you made it impossible for me to deliver, and then you say, yeah, I did, but it should have slowed you up only half and not the other because you could have taken the alternative route.
Richard, if you look to TOLS and compare the number of cases in which foreseeability is used and comparative fault is used, it's 1 to 1,000. It's 1 to 1,000.
I said the foresight stuff I think is a dead loser.
Yeah.
I mean, it's talked about, but it's rarely invoked. And the famous case that invoked it, the wagon mount case, is really a sequential
right.
wrong case.
No,
I mean, it has nothing to do with foresight.
Like
I said, I think foreseeability is the refuge of a scoundrel. It doesn't give you anything.
Oh, exactly.
And for the most part, therefore, you don't use it. And you take the leading case of foresight, the wagon mount case, that's a case where I create a dangerous condition, and you have a choice of either taking the risk or not. You decide to continue to use the blowtorch, and it goes up. And the right measure of damages is the mitigation cost that you would have had if you decided to clean the thing up, and then you take the risk of all the excess stuff. I mean, you don't need foresight at all to handle the case.
But I think that's what Fabrizio said when I also
well,
agree.
I mean, I think the point of disagreement is that the system of allocation that I'm using is not a comparative fault system.
Yeah.
It's essentially a much more precise way of figuring out how the replication will reinstate part, but not all of the course.
But it would apply also to different situations, right? I mean, sometimes if you use foreseeability, it could make something which is similar to comparative fault, but in other cases it won't.
Yes, well, and in those cases where it doesn't, it gets fictionalized away. It's always foreseeable.
But just to understand, your claim is that at least in the U.S., impossibility or impracticability would apply also to partial performance.
Yeah.
To the extent that the comparative fault could apply.
Well, I mean, it would, yeah. I mean, it would cover the same domain of cases, but it gives you, I think, a different way of calculating.
We do have the same notion in Europe of a partial impossibility,
yeah.
But it's considered to be an exception to a total impossibility.
Yes, and as it is.
So I wouldn't reach the same conclusion.
We have the same sort of view.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.